I'm Montse Alvarado. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
Southern Baptists, I think, have finally found the right opportunity to speak clearly on this issue.
A major Christian denomination formally opposes in vitro fertilization, what this could mean for the November election.
Abortion is not just an issue. It is the greatest human rights abuse of our time.
Keeping the pressure on Capitol Hill to end abortion and to recognize the sanctity of preborn life.
The protocols currently being pushed on children and adolescents violate the fundamental precepts of Hippocratic medicine.
Bad medicine. Doctors vow to protect children from radical transgender surgeries and hormone prescriptions.
The Supreme Court's decision on the abortion pill mifepristone tops our show today. Justices rejected the challenge to the Food and Drug Administration's lifting of safety regulations on the pill. The FDA allows the abortion pill to be prescribed via telemedicine and delivered through the mail. Mifepristone is used in more than 50% of abortions in the United States. With this decision, abortion pills will continue to be available to patients without an in-person doctor's visit and received through the mail. We will have analysis on this decision next week on Pro-Life Weekly. A major announcement on in vitro fertilization from the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the largest Protestant denomination in the United States. On Wednesday, during the convention's annual meeting, delegates officially condemned the use of IVF. In a resolution, they call on their members to reaffirm the unconditional value and right to life of every human being, including those in an embryonic stage, and to only utilize reproductive technologies consistent with that affirmation. The Southern Baptist Convention is seen as a barometer of evangelicalism in the U.S., with nearly 50,000 churches and some 13 million members. So does this vote indicate a shift in the pro-life movement? Andrew Walker, Associate Professor of Ethics at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, joins us now to talk further about this resolution. Andrew, what is the history of IVF for Southern Baptists? Is this the first time the convention speaks out against the process?
Yeah, first off, thanks for having me on to share about this. I think this is a pretty significant moment because as far as my understanding of the history is concerned, Southern Baptists have never gone on the record prior to what transpired this week in Indianapolis about in vitro fertilization. This is obviously an issue that has it's not new. IVF came around in 1978. So we are nearly 50 years downstream from the artificial reproductive technology revolution. And this is a moment where Southern Baptists, I think, have finally found the right opportunity to speak clearly on this issue.
And how significant is this for the denomination? We're talking about a, like you were saying, a 50-year cycle where something like this did also happen with contraception. Obviously, pronouncements on the life issue are very common. Where are we on this?
I think it's both very important and then also rather mundane or routine. Here's what I mean by that. I think what we saw happen in Indianapolis this week is Southern Baptists really bring to bear the full force and logic of their underlying human dignity ethic. So the Southern Baptist Convention is known as one of the most pro-life denominations in the entire United States, particularly around the issue of abortion. Up until this week, we had not yet brought those convictions to bear officially in the form of a resolution until what transpired this week in Indianapolis. And so I don't think it's revolutionary necessarily. It is merely extending the logic of what we believe is true about human beings at every stage of their development, including the human embryo.
Now, you were one of the drafters of this resolution that was voted on. Did you think this was possible? And you already described how much weight this has, but was this your expected outcome?
I did expect the resolution to be well received on the floor of the Southern Baptist Convention. There was some floor debate, some very kind individuals who expressed some concerns with the resolution. But the floor of the Southern Baptist Convention is a very conservative floor. It's a very conservative constituency. As I said, we're a very pro-life denomination. If if Southern Baptists have an opportunity to bring their pro-life ethic to bear on every issue that it needs to bear upon, I think Southern Baptists should. And this week we demonstrated that we did. And so I think that this is, again, a major moment for bioethics in America. I think it's a major moment for Protestant bioethics. And I think it's a very significant moment simply because Southern Baptists are often treated as a bellwether for broader kind of evangelical attitudes on any given issue in the culture today.
Absolutely. And we'll talk about that in a second. What is then the basis for this position for non-Catholic Christians, the anthropology, the bioethics of this?
It begins with the affirmation that every human being is made in God's image. That comes from Genesis 1, 26 through 28. The idea here is that to be made in God's image is not something that we carve out exceptions to based on the size, the environment, the location, the degree of dependency of the human person. That human persons are human persons at every stage of their development. And this is something that, again, we see affirmed in Genesis, which is why I don't see this as a necessarily controversial resolution. It's merely working out the full force and logic of what we believe Scripture to teach, is that we don't get to deny human beings their full dignity and their full humanity based on some arbitrary classification that technology allows us to parcel out.
Well, it's certainly a significant step in Christian unity. How might, then, this impact the November elections? You alluded to this a little bit. A recent Pew poll noted that 81% of white evangelical Protestant voters would back the presumptive Republican candidate, Donald Trump, who has been in favor of IVF alongside many other Republicans.
I think we're at a very early stage in this conversation, and I think that it's actually perhaps too preliminary to think about how this resolution and the SBC and evangelicals' attitudes towards IVF could have practical consequence in the election this year. But I do think that Southern Baptists are aware that probably the culture is very much stacked against us on this issue. I'm a political realist. I understand that on the Republican and Democratic side alike, there is no demand or no desire to ban, let alone regulate, IVF. So this is one of those issues where Southern Baptists need to speak clearly, regardless of the political consequences. We don't pick and choose what we say based on whether it is deemed likable in the culture or not. And so, you know, witnessing to the truth for the sake of the truth is something that we're called to do, regardless of the consequences, knowing that we probably have a very long-term conversation to have that thankfully we just began this week.
Well, we certainly believe in that here at EWTN. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
On the same day of the Southern Baptist Convention vote, all 49 Senate Republicans signed a statement supporting access to IVF. Their statement, however, was directed at Senate Democrats, not the Southern Baptist Convention.
We're here to reject the lie that some human beings can be discarded simply because of their size, their dependence, or because others view them as unwanted or inconvenient.
Calling for equal protection for all human life from the moment of conception. The pro-life organization Live Action and others, including members of Congress and medical professionals, gathered on Capitol Hill this week to be a voice for the voiceless. The news conference comes just weeks before the two-year anniversary of the historic Dobbs ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade. Since that historic ruling, several states have enacted pro-life laws. Pro-abortionists have challenged many of these laws in the courts. On Capitol Hill, recent Democrat-led committee hearings have taken direct aim at pro-life legislation, including one just this Wednesday. But pro-life advocates made sure to speak up, too. Let's take a listen.
Even when people are able to access abortion care by traveling, this travel comes at enormous cost to many who are already bearing the brunt of inequitable access to care. It comes at financial cost, the cost of the abortion itself, the cost of travel. It comes with a logistical cost, finding a place to stay, arranging for childcare, since most abortion patients are already parents, being able to request time off work. And it can come with an emotional cost, navigating an incredibly complex and quickly changing legal landscape in order to access care,
Pregnancy centers are a critical social service organization offering support and comprehensive care for young women to continue healthy pregnancies, the birth of healthy babies, and to deliver pre- and postnatal care to babies and families. These organizations, which are vital to the communities they serve and are commonly operated by faith-based organizations, but not always, are often maligned by radical left-wing abortion groups and are frequent targets of vandalism and often violence.
Just last week, another committee hearing targeted abortion bans, with claims from Democrats that these pro-life laws were causing chaos in the healthcare industry. Christina Bennett, a news correspondent with Live Action, led the news conference on Capitol Hill. She joins us now to talk further about working to build a culture of life in the halls of Congress and the minds of all Americans. Christina, welcome to the show. Why did you decide to do this call for reorganizing, recognizing the preborn person right now?
It's very important for people to understand that even though we celebrated the historic victory of Roe versus Wade being overturned, over 2,000 babies are still dying every single day from abortion, and especially in states like mine, Connecticut, where abortion is still on demand, even paid for by taxpayer dollars. And so we're grateful for the progress that we've made, but it's important for people to know that we need justice for all preborn children, and we need Congress to create legislation based on the 14th Amendment to protect all human lives.
It's really important, especially with an election season this year. Now, there are two bills in Congress related to in vitro fertilization. Neither is likely to pass. Have you found allies on either side on this particular issue, or that understand that IVF is the commercialization of life?
It is a complicated situation, and one that, unfortunately, not as many people are willing to take a stand on. At Live Action, we have been bold, and we have let people know that IVF is something that is immoral and it leads to the deaths of children. But it is something that it can be hard at times to have people support us.
Well, you recently addressed the United Nations on the International Day of Families. You stressed the importance of human development education in schools. How was that received?
It was received really well. It was an honor to be able to speak at the UN, especially knowing that people like Mother Teresa had previously spoken at the UN. It was an honor to be able to follow in a small way in her footsteps, and especially on the International Day of Families, to see people from member nations from across the globe who also believe in the power of family and know that it is the most important foundation for a society, to be with people and to let them see the baby Olivia video and to watch them in wonder looking at the beauty of fetal development. It was a really memorable experience.
Now, that was a historic first, the ability to show that video and to show the continuum of life from conception to natural birth. Live Action has recently really taken on the education side of this with their human development curriculum that's going around the country. Why is that, the education piece of this, such a priority?
It's a priority because people are miseducated, especially when it comes to public schools. So many times Planned Parenthood is the one that's going into public schools, they're going into health classes, and they're deceiving young people into thinking that, oh, this is just tissue, this is just cells, and this child can be discarded. And they've gone to thousands of classrooms for decades, and that has led to many young people having abortions. And so we are going in and we're using baby Olivia as a tool to educate people and to show them this is what's happening in the womb. It's not just tissues and cells. It is a living, growing human being that is worthy of protection.
Well, Christina, thank you for your witness and your truth. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. God bless.
To follow pro-life and pro-abortion laws, as well as what states will be voting on these issues this November, head over to our sister news organization, the Catholic News Agency, on their website.
Medical decision-making should respect biological reality and the dignity of the person.
18 medical and health policy organizations, including the American College of Pediatricians, are calling for an end to the controversial practice of so-called gender-affirming care. In a recently released declaration, they urge medical organizations to immediately stop the promotion of social affirmation, puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and surgeries for children and adolescents who experience distress over their biological sex. Just this April, the National Health Service in England stopped routinely prescribing puberty blockers to those under 18. The NHS made the decision after commissioning a review of several studies. They follow similar protocols in other European countries. Norway's Healthcare Investigation Board ruled in 2023 a lack of medical evidence supporting puberty blockers or reassignment surgery and issued guidelines to restrict those methods to research settings only. In 2022, Swedish health officials issued guidelines limiting puberty blockers, hormones, and mastectomies for minors. Along similar lines, Finland urges psychotherapy instead of puberty blockers, with surgery not offered to those under 18. France calls for the utmost reserve on hormone treatments for minors, and lawmakers are calling for a ban on gender transitions for minors. And a recent report published by the group Environmental Progress just this spring claims the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, or WPATH, one of the leading advocates for gender transition in minors, were actually aware of the dangerous and potentially deadly side effects of these treatments, but supported them anyway. Dr. Paul Hruus was one of the many doctors that backed the declaration to protect children from these life-altering surgeries and hormone treatments. Thank you for joining us. Why was this declaration made now? Why not sooner?
It's very timely in that with the movement to greater caution internationally, what is happening here in the United States is really digging in and continuing to use this affirmative model of care. So now the United States is really the outlier worldwide in continuing to insist that there is adequate evidence to support this intervention. And many efforts here in the United States to draw attention to the many, many concerns have been dismissed as being fringe views. And this declaration really illustrates the magnitude of the concern across the medical profession and many of the physicians that previously had not felt comfortable expressing their reservations and concerns are now stepping forward to join the effort to draw attention to the dangers of the current model that's being used in the United States.
The value of strength in numbers. Well, what are the impacts of gender surgeries and puberty suppressing hormones on children? Once they have surgery or take pills, is there any chance of turning back?
And that is one of the major concerns, since there's so little we know about the cause of this condition, and we know that this affirmative approach is actually leading many children to proceed into later stages of intervention that really have lifelong impact, including effects on fertility, likelihood of sterility lifelong, and other medical risks. By receiving these interventions without adequate understanding of the full spectrum of risks, knowing that they already have risks, and what is now becoming apparent is that the arguments of showing benefit are based upon very weak data, and at best one can say we have no idea, but I think there's certainly already evidence that they continue to suffer. So the goal is to really provide truly helpful care to these affected individuals, and we can't do that until we acknowledge that the current model is lacking in that scientific evidence.
Dr. Hruus, how early are you seeing these controversial practices happening in American children?
It is important to know that initially when they were proposed in Europe, in the Dutch protocol, that the administration of cross-sex hormones was reserved until 16 years of age, and surgeries were not offered until the age of majority after 18 years. In the latest iteration of the WPATH guidelines, that they have removed all age restrictions. That means that girls as young as 8 years of age, boys as young as 9 years of age could be offered puberty blockers, and really very shortly thereafter exposed to hormones. We know that there are certainly recorded cases of children as early as 12 years of age undergoing bilateral mastectomy for females that desire to appear as males.
So then what are the right treatments, the medical treatments for gender dysphoria?
There still is much that we need to learn about how to effectively care for this very unique patient population. But what we do know is that there's underlying psychiatric morbidities, depression and anxiety that exist that's very prevalent in this patient population. And certainly we have effective tools to be able to provide a care. There's also evidence that needs further research as to whether by choosing an approach to address the underlying psychological difficulties will have benefit in this population. That does not carry the same risk as the affirmative approach when one is embarking upon administering powerful hormones, progressing on to surgeries with irreversible and potentially lifelong complications.
Well, we'll keep watching this as the science and the policies develop. Thank you so much, Dr. Ruse.
My pleasure.
The state of Arkansas recorded zero abortions for the year 2023, although that data does not include women who traveled out of state or took the abortion pill received in the mail. Arkansas is one of 14 states with a total ban on abortion. Prior to the historic Dobbs versus Jackson decision in 2022, the Arkansas Department of Health reported an average of 3,200 abortions a year. The state is providing more support for mothers in need as well. The governor signed a measure in April approving $2 million to support pregnancy resource centers, maternity homes, and adoption agencies. Coming up, not a rookie of the year, gold medalist, or Olympian, but in every way deserving of gracing the front of a cereal box. The historic first after the break.
We are honored to present Marianne Glendon with the inaugural Given Fiat Award.
Plus, a woman who upheld the church's teachings on contraception and abortion on the international stage is awarded for her service to the church. Praying the Holy Rosary as a national march for life kicks off. An estimated 3,000 people took part in the demonstration on the Esplanade of Ministries in Brasilia on Tuesday. Marchers ended at the National Congress, where they asked federal deputies to approve a bill that would make abortion after 22 weeks a crime akin to homicide. Abortions are legal in Brazil if it is the result of a rape or puts the mother's life in danger. Advocacy for the preborn also in the halls of higher education, inside government buildings, and at podiums on the international stage. One woman who has upheld church teaching on life in all of these environments is Marianne Glendon. She received an award this week for her mentorship of students and fortitude in the public square as a Catholic leader.
A public acknowledgement of gratitude to God for a woman who exemplifies the three pillars of Given, and who stands as a living testimony to the transformative power of a life dedicated to excellence and love.
Glendon joyfully accepted the inaugural Fiat Award from the Given Institute. The Institute is dedicated to providing mentorship for young adult women, and Glendon is definitely a leader in the church we can all look up to. Marianne Glendon is a professor of law at Harvard University, former U.S. ambassador to the Holy See, former board member at the Vatican Bank, a member of the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences and the Pontifical Council for the Laity, to name a few of her many honored positions, past and present. I had the opportunity to sit down with her moments after she received this distinguished award to talk a little bit about how she first dipped her toes into the pro-life movement.
When I could, I became involved in a small way in the pro-life movement in Boston, and together with some other women, we got very concerned that back in those days, the pro-life movement was being treated in the press as indifferent to the concerns of women. And so we formed an organization that we called Women Affirming Life, and we said, we had a motto on our letterhead that said, we are pro-child, pro-woman, pro-life, and pro-poor. And that was about all I thought I could do in the beginning. But then I figured out that I could direct some of my academic research toward questions that weren't getting proper attention. So I did a comparative study of how abortion is regulated in 26 Western nations. And the study showed that the United States, after Roe, had a far more extreme approach than any of those other countries. That, strange to say, and I don't think it could happen today, but that book, which won a prize and was published by Harvard University Press, that book was what got me an offer from Harvard Law School for a tenured position.
Congratulations to Marianne Glendon on this award. You can find out more about the Given Institute by visiting their website. And now to highlight another kind of award that is a historic first. A pregnant woman is featured on the front of a cereal box. Best-selling cookbook author Molly Baz is shown at 39 weeks pregnant, gracing the front of Special K. On her Instagram account, she writes that the campaign is all about celebrating pregnant bodies everywhere. We hope to see more pregnant women celebrated in similar ways. Congratulations to Molly on her pregnancy. That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like us and follow us on our social media channels and sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.